Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events in the Vatican. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus walked along and saw a man who'd been blind from birth. Jesus spat on the ground, made mud with his saliva, and smeared the man's eyes with the mud. Then he told him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam." This name means one who has been sent. So the man went off and washed, and came back, able to see. His neighbors and the people who'd been accustomed to see him begging began to ask, "Isn't this the fellow who used to sit and beg?" Some were claiming it was he, others maintained it was not, but someone who looked like him. The man himself said, "I'm the one, all right." Next, they took the man who'd been born blind to the Pharisees. Note that it was on a Sabbath that Jesus had made the mud paste and opened his eyes. The Pharisees in turn began to inquire how he'd recovered his sight. He told them, "He put mud on my eyes, I washed it off, and now I can see." This prompted some of the Pharisees to assert, "This man cannot be from God because he does not keep the Sabbath." Others objected, "If a man is a sinner, how can he perform signs like these?" They were sharply divided over him. Then they addressed the blind man again. "Since it was your eyes he opened, what do you have to say about him?" "He is a prophet," he replied. "What," they exclaimed, "you are steeped in sin from your birth and you're giving us lectures?" With that, they threw him out bodily. When Jesus heard of his expulsion, he sought him out and asked him, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" "You have seen him," Jesus replied. "He's speaking to you now." "I do believe, Lord," he said, and bowed down to worship him.
The first thing that strikes one in the opening lines of this gospel is the exactness of the description of the man Jesus saw as he walked along. A man who had been blind from birth. Not just a blind man, but one who had been born blind. John, the only evangelist who recounts this episode, this miracle, wants us to have all the facts. And in the long version of the gospel, the man himself emphasizes that he was born blind, when he expresses his amazement at the incredulity of the Pharisees.
"Ever since the world began, it is unheard of for anyone to open the eyes of a man who was blind. If this man were not from God, he couldn't do a thing."
The man's parents, too, are interrogated and confirm that, yes, he was born blind. If the event had taken place today, the authorities would no doubt ask if the man had always been visually impaired. I wonder sometimes what they think, those of our fellow men and women who are lumped under the general category of handicapped because they do not possess hearing or sight or speech to the full, when instead of being described simply as blind or deaf or dumb, they're given some fancy name, in the belief that the euphemism will in some way make them feel better. Euphemism, the use of a pleasing term for one that is harsh or offensive, a softened expression. I can't help thinking that it's the one who uses the euphemism who's afraid of being hurt or offended, merely because the blind or deaf or dumb man or woman exists and makes him or her feel uncomfortable for being whole. It's just a thought. The tables are turned sometimes, though, when one we believed impaired is suddenly seen to possess something the rest of us lack. As in this poem by W.H. Davies. If you've ever been lost in the fog, you won't need to use much imagination.
I saw the fog grow thick, which soon made blind my ken. It made tall men of boys and giants of tall men. It clutched my throat. I coughed. Nothing was in my head except two heavy eyes like balls of burning lead. And when it grew so black that I could know no place, I lost all judgment then of distance and of space. The street lamps and the lights upon the halted cars could either be on earth or be the heavenly stars. A man passed by me close. I asked my way. He said, "Come, follow me, my friend." I followed where he led. He rapped the stones in front. "Trust me," he said, "and come." I followed like a child. A blind man led me home.
For someone who's always had perfect sight, it's hard to relate to total blindness, especially blindness from birth. It's perhaps easier to do so if the blind person in question was once able to see. Our sympathy is also more easily aroused because we know, and the person now blind knows, what has been lost. Moreover, the thought of losing one's sight is a frightening one. Rudyard Kipling suffered from this fear as a child and was obliged to wear glasses, which were uncommon in those days, he wrote. And he explored the theme of losing sight in a novel, The Light That Failed. Of the moment when blindness finally takes over, he writes, "Something cracked inside his temples like an overstrained bowstring, and he was alone in the thick night." In a gentle poem entitled simply Going Blind, the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke writes,
"She'd sat just like the others there at tea, and then I'd seem to notice that her cup was being a little differently picked up. She'd smiled once. It had almost hurt to see. And when eventually they rose and talked, and slowly, and as chance led, were dispersing through several rooms there, laughing and conversing, I noticed her. Behind the rest she walked subduedly, like someone who presently will have to sing, and with so many listening. On those bright eyes of hers, with pleasure glistening, played, as on pools, an outer radiancy. She followed slowly, and she needed time, as though some long ascent were not yet by, and yet as though when she had ceased to climb, she would no longer merely walk, but fly."
For a poet or painter to lose sight would seem a tragic destiny indeed. But in a famous sonnet, John Milton came to terms with the situation. Here now is On His Blindness.
"When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day labor, light denied? I fondly ask, but patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies. God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. He who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve, who only stand and wait."
Standing and waiting always in the vicinity of the temple were the lame, the cripples, the beggars. And among them on this occasion, the man born blind. When the disciples point him out to Jesus, they don't ask him to heal the man, but rather to tell them whether the man had sinned or his parents, voicing the common belief that physical disabilities were a punishment from God. Our Lord's answer is unequivocal.
Neither he nor his parents sinned. He was born blind, so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as the day lasts, I must carry out the work of the one who sent me. The night will soon be here when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world.
And without more ado, Jesus proceeds to give light to the blind eyes of the man before him, using first a common gesture which would have been familiar to the disciples and any onlookers. For it was believed that saliva and mud possessed curative qualities for diseases of the eyes. On a previous occasion at Bethsaida, he had cured a blind man, using saliva only and working the miracle in two stages.
Then, putting spittle on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked, "Can you see anything?" The man, who was beginning to see, replied, "I can see people. They look like trees to me, but they're walking about." Then he laid his hands on the man's eyes again, and he saw clearly. He was cured, and he could see everything plainly and distinctly.
We don't know if this man had always been blind, but the fact that people looked like trees walking suggests that he had seen trees. I wonder. Whatever the case, our Lord gives to both these miracles a slow time sequence, as if he wants to make sure the message goes home, as the ending shows in this episode, where the question is not whether the man has received his physical sight, but whether he has the light of faith. "I do believe, Lord," he said. But let's take a look at the place where the miracle actually happened. It wasn't in our Lord's presence even, but at the Pool of Siloam. On my map of Jerusalem, it's called Hezekiah's Pool. Hezekiah was king in Jerusalem 700 years before Christ, when the city was under threat of siege by the Assyrians. And as the only spring of water was situated just outside the old city of David, Hezekiah decided to cut a long underground tunnel and so bring the spring water into the city. He then sealed up the spring and hid it from the advancing army of Sennacherib. Today, the Virgin's Fountain, as the spring is known, provides the water for the Pool of Siloam at the other end of Hezekiah's tunnel. The healing of the man born blind took place shortly after the Feast of Tabernacles. During that feast, which lasted a week, a procession to the Pool of Siloam took place every morning. The water, which was brought back in a golden pitcher, was poured out in libation before the altar of the Most High. As the priest drew the water, the choir chanted from Isaiah.
"You shall draw water with gladness from the fountains of salvation."
Our Lord's choice of the pool for the working of the miracle must have added to the fury of the Pharisees, apart from the fact that it happened on the Sabbath. For it reminded them of how the prophet Elisha had sent Naaman the leper to wash in the Jordan. For us, it calls up a different image, that of the constant procession of sick pilgrims to wash in the waters of Lourdes. "Go and drink from the spring and wash yourself there," the lady said to Bernadette. And the girl made for the river Gave.
"But she told me this was not the place. And then she pointed out, with her finger, where I ought to go. I went, but found only a little pool of dirty water. I dipped my hand in, but could not hold any, so I started to scrape the earth away, and I was able to take some. Three times I threw it away. The fourth time I managed to drink some.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. And now, our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, gives us a roundup of the past week's events here in the Vatican. OK, Joan, so let's start our weekly roundup with Sunday.
And actually, a little bit before Sunday, I think the big news last weekend, in addition, obviously, to the Angelus, which is always a wonderful story, but the Vatican did announce that, or confirm, that Pope Francis will make an apostolic trip to Egypt on April 28th and 29th. This is answering invitations from Egypt's president, the Catholic bishops, Coptic Pope Tewodros II, and the Grand Imam of the Mosque of Al-Azhar. So he'll visit the city of Cairo. This will be his 18th foreign trip. So kind of a big news leading into the weekend and Sunday. Then this is interesting because Sunday, of course, March 19th, and that is always the feast of the solemnity of St. Joseph. However, when it falls on a Sunday in Lent, the actual solemnity is transferred to the next day. However, the Pope obviously did celebrate the Angelus and had his reflections before and after the Angelus prayer. And interestingly enough, because March 19th in Italy is also Father's Day, and the Pope kind of made a reference to this when he recalled the beatification the previous day, Saturday, of Joseph Meyer Nusser. And he said this happened in Bolzano, Italy, and the Pope said, because of his great moral and spiritual stature, Blessed Joseph is a model for the lay faithful, especially for fathers whom we remember with great affection today. And, of course, this new blessed was a married layman and head of a family and big supporter of Catholic Action. And the main thing about his story was that in 1944, he was conscripted into the German army, but he refused to take the Hitler oath. He was condemned to death and actually died on his way to the Dachau concentration camp. But and then also there was an appeal Sunday for the flood victims in Peru at the Angelus. The Pope assured the people of his closeness to them in prayer at this time, that time when their country had been struck by devastating floods. So then we moved to Monday, which actually was the solemnity, the celebration of the solemnity of St. Joseph. And there were several interesting pieces of news. The Pope did receive the prelates of El Salvador there in their Rome for their ad limina visit. And, of course, that takes place of the March 24th feast day of the former Archbishop of San Salvador who had been killed by a hired gunman. And that feast day this week fell on Friday, the 24th of March.
We're talking here of Blessed Oscar Romeo.
Yes, yes, exactly. And also on Monday, the agenda was published for the papal trip to Fatima in May 12 and 13. A presidential welcome upon his arrival, a stop at Fatima's stadium before he goes to the shrine, where, of course, he's going to pray in the Chapel of the Apparitions. He will greet pilgrims present, recite the rosary with them. Sunday, of course, the main event of the day after meetings with Prime Minister and others will be Mass at the Basilica of Our Lady of the Rosary of Fatima.
Another interesting story on Monday. He also met the president of Rwanda that day, Paul Kagame, and it was interesting that he offered an apology for the failings, as he put it, on the part of some members of the church who took part in the Rwandan genocide.
In the 94 that was, genocide, the Hutus and the Tutsis,
and that
exactly.
was quite a significant
that
gesture.
That was the headline from that meeting, as a matter of fact. Yes, indeed, that was the news headline from that meeting.
Okay, let's move on to Wednesday now in the general audience.
After a quiet Tuesday, we had Wednesday. But again, on Tuesdays, the Pope mostly prepares Wednesday.
Indeed.
His catechesis for the day. And it's very interesting. One of the highlights, really, of that audience was the Pope's call for an ongoing commitment to welcome and integrate forced migrants and refugees. And he described the current migrant situation or phenomenon as the world's greatest tragedy after the Second World War.
Strong words.
Very, very, very strong words. And in this audience, he was speaking specifically to an Italian association called the Migrantes Foundation. This is actually an arm of the Italian Bishops' Conference that promotes the pastoral care of migrants and refugees arriving in Italy. And noting the services they offer and the help they give, the Pope highlighted the rights and responsibilities of those who receive and of those who are received. So there's rights and responsibilities on both ends.
A two-way process,
and, yes.
And the migrants themselves also have a responsibility
exactly.
towards their host countries.
Exactly. As we do, who aren't migrants but came to another country to work, and we have responsibilities. And then, of course, in the catechesis, the Pope was continuing his thoughts on Christian hope, and he appealed to the faithful to rediscover the sacrament of reconciliation. And he also highlighted two words. He spoke of the attitudes of steadfastness and encouragement, saying they're intimately connected to the reality of Christian hope, because ours is a God of steadfastness, because he loves us perseveringly, never tires of consoling us, but he's also a God of encouragement who calls us to be close to the weak and the needy, with whom he asks us to be strong and sowers of hope. So this little fabric woven there of three threads, hope the main one, and then steadfastness and encouragement. And then there was another appeal, if you might say his words on the migrants were an appeal. There was another appeal at the audience. The Holy Father reminded all Catholic communities to participate in the this weekend's 24 Hours for the Lord, with churches all across the globe offering the sacrament of confession as he called it, a privileged moment of grace during our Lenten journey. And then there was kind of a cute moment at the,
yes.
Interesting moment at the audience. I guess there always is one or two or ten with the Holy Father. But there were a group of lifeguards from across Italy, 1,500 of them, who presented Pope Francis with backpacks filled with products to distribute to the poor. And they came from all areas of Italy. The coastal resort business representatives joined them in this, all wearing distinctive red jackets at the audience, and these were supposed to be backpacks filled with personal toiletries and items that the such as toothpaste, razors,
all essentials
exactly that poor and or homeless might need. And then, as if he didn't have enough to do that day, on Wednesday, the Holy Father greeted participants in a Vatican conference on water, on the value and values of water. Now, this was promoted by the Pontifical Council for Culture because Wednesday was the 25th World Water Day. This was set up years ago by the United Nations. And the title of the conference was Watershed, Replenishing Water Values for a Thirsty World. So a very interesting talk to that group, and then we move from Wednesday to a very busy Thursday. And of course, Wednesday we saw the attacks, the terror attacks in London, and you were just there days ago, so
yes.
you want to thank your lucky stars in certain moments of life, right?
Indeed.
But the Holy Father did send a telegram of condolences to Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the Archbishop of Westminster, expressing his sorrow for the victims of the attack at the House of Parliament, near the House of Parliament in London on Wednesday. Now, as is usual, it was the Cardinal Secretary of State who sent the telegram in the Pope's name, and the Pope said he was deeply saddened to learn of the loss of life and the injuries caused by the attack in London, and expresses his prayerful solidarity with all those affected by the tragedy. And then in a totally different vein, the Holy Father on Thursday received Cardinal Angelo Amato, prefect of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, and he recognized a miracle attributed to the intercession of two of the Fatima children, Blessed Francisco and Jacinta Marto. Now, they were brother and sister, but they were cousins to Sister Lucia, who, of course, lived the longest of the three children to whom the Virgin appeared. And that same day, Thursday, the Pope approved the canonizations of 30 Brazilians and 3 Mexican martyrs, all of them martyrs. So, again, we do know, because we heard the itinerary, that the Pope will visit Fatima on May 12th and 13th on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the apparition of Mary to the three children in Fatima. And then also on Thursday, the Pope had another private audience with an African president, with Paul Biya, president of the Republic of Cameroon. And then Friday, obviously a very big day, because we've had leaders from 27 European Union heads of state and government have been filtering into Rome all week long for the anniversary on Saturday of the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome that led to the formation of the European Common Market, really the precursor of what today we call the EU, the European Union. And then there were presidents and other officers of institutions linked with the European Union. And so the Holy Father's address to them was kind of an unusual hour, actually, 6 o'clock on Friday. And you and I know, because of coming to work, I'm a little more fortunate and getting closer to the Vatican than you are, but kind of a major lockdown situation in Rome. And just in previous days, I'd been around the city for other meetings, and you could see some subtle and some not so subtle signs of security. But right now, where we are in the Vatican, many streets are closed to traffic. Other streets are closed to parking cars, etc. And
a major lockdown.
Major lockdown. And the European Union is in a moment of facing huge challenges. We have Brexit, high levels of unemployment in several countries, debt crises in others, the growth of populist movements, and a backlash in quite a number of countries against welcoming immigrants and refugees. And of course, as we just heard minutes ago, we said that this was a topic touched upon Wednesday by Pope Francis in the general audience.
And a lot of the press picked up on the fact that he made those remarks, literally, as you say, just 2 days before this major anniversary celebration of the EU with all those.
And his words will be studied, obviously, too. The group will be studied in depth. They're supposed to come out after all the leaders on Saturday are signing a declaration after their meetings. It'll be very interesting to see down the road what, if anything, this declaration signed over the weekend and their meetings and the meeting with the Holy Father, if any of this had any effect on the challenges that we just listed.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much as usual, Joan, and speak to you next week.
God bless.
Bye. And thanks there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.